On Monday, August 8th, Tall Can Audio hits 1,000 episodes.
Wait, that's still on? Who could possibly still care?
And the gang is all here to celebrate.
It's euphoric. It's got to be close to nirvana. It's outstanding.
For the first time ever, Maddie, Michaela, Rob, and Matt are all live in studio together.
It's happening, you guys! It's happening! Oh, my God, guys! Oh, my God! I wish you all were here!
Is this likely to go well?
Just check my notes here. No!
At least it will make a lot of noise.
Boom. Here comes the boom.
1,000 pods and 1,000 pints.
I don't think I've ever been as proud in my entire life.
TCA 1000 drops Monday, August 8th, wherever you find low-quality podcasts.
Fuck, it's out of control. Shit.
Like one third more sports than a normal can.
How's it going, everybody? Welcome to Tall Can Sports for a post Grey Cup edition, we'll call it. We'll have the same guy who actually turned out to be dead on correct in our pregame preview show, Nate Sager of The Score and Sportsnet and bunch of other places back with us. How's it going, Nate?
Great. Now, what did I say that was correct? I think I took Calgary to win, didn't I?
Yes, but so did I. What you were correct on, and I was dead wrong on, was that if Ottawa was going to have a chance to win, I said it would have to be low scoring. You corrected me and said, no, it's going to have to be the other way around. You're not going to shut down Calgary, so you're going to have to outscore them kind of thing. And that turned out to be pretty much dead on, 39-33. It's a pretty good gunslinging matchup.
Yeah, I didn't even realize this. It was a record for most passing yards in a Grey Cup, like combined by the two quarterbacks.
Really?
Yeah, Henry Burris threw for 461, which was like the fourth highest total.
Yeah.
461 at 41 years old on one leg.
It's not bad.
Yeah, yeah. If anyone wants, people were like, oh, yeah, it's like Peyton Manning. Like, no.
No, it's not.
The Broncos carried the reanimated corpse of Peyton to a Super Bowl. I mean, I hate CFL, NFL analogies anyway, because they're two different things. I mean, the only thing that's really in common is they both play in a game with a ball that has points on the end, right?
Let's say that Super Bowl you're referring to is affectionately known as Weekend of Peyton's, right?
Yeah.
Well, since you've said it to pet peeviers, why don't I start with one? Why don't we talk right off the hop here? Because there was a couple other places I was looking to start, but you've brought it up. So let's, how about the NFL comparison of the Pete Carroll decision a couple of years back versus what Dave Dickinson decided to do at second down, second and goal right at the very end of the game? Any comparison there? Anything you think that for people who didn't see the game, if you didn't see the game, you're probably not listening to this, but Andrew Buckley, the backup quarterback's in the game, he rolls out to pass and gets taken down. You know, you have the best quarterback in the league on the bench. You've got a running back sitting right there that you could have used. What were your thoughts on that decision and maybe just how it does compare to the Pete Carroll decision?
Well, it is analogous. I have a hilarious story about the Pete Carroll decision because I was watching that game with people. Really, I was. And one of the people, it was like a guy who's not a football fan at all.
Right.
And it's like when that happened, when, you know, the Seahawks were on the 1 yard line going in for the winning touchdown, and 10-ply Wilson, as I always call him, Russell. Because he's the only guy I've ever seen who slides 8 yards behind the line of scrimmage. You know, they call a slant pattern, and Malcolm Butler jumps it, intercepts, and instead of running, you know, giving the ball to Marshawn Lynch, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And, I mean, there was all these things about clock management and whatnot, but in the end of the day, So we're all sitting there in stunned silence that this just happened. This one guy who had never watched a football game in his life, literally, just sort of finally speaks. Shouldn't they have given it to that Lynch guy? I just kept imagining him like watching Rick. Shouldn't they have given it to that Messam guy? Pounds, but no, I actually, you know, Calgary all year long, when they got on the goal line, they put in Andrew Buckley. And I mean, yeah, people can be like, oh, Canadian rookie and all this stuff, but that was his thing all year. And he, I believe they rarely, if ever, got stopped in that situation. And you also have to be thinking that you're in a scenario where you're in goal to go, pop, you know, very likely to score. If you hand the ball off inside, there's a chance someone could punch the ball down. If you roll them out,
right?
Yeah, sure. There's a better opportunity. And the worst case scenario is you still, you know, preserve the chance to kick the field goal. And I mean, it wasn't Buckley's fault. I mean, the fact of the matter is the fullback Rob Cote completely whiffed on his block.
Right.
Canadian is able to get in there, and he did the thing where he, you know, basically managed to grab one heel, you know, make Buckley click his heels and fall down. I mean, it was maybe a bit of a poorly. I think it was just a poorly executed play.
For sure it was, but I guess if you're gonna send in a passing play, the honor argument would be, why wouldn't you send your guy back in? I agree. You send in the rookie, the Canadian guy, to punch it in those hard yards, right? When you're gonna try and run it straight up the middle, either him or hand it off, but I think if you're going to roll out to pass, you're probably better off sticking with your guy, don't you think?
Yeah, but there's always the thing. You don't change what you did in the season, in the playoffs. That's when you start to change things, is when things can blow up in your face.
Well, that's true.
I just think that someone, you know, basically came down to someone missed a block, and that's that. But, I mean, people want to sit there and get caught up in, you know, personalities and labels, right? Oh, they put in the Canadian guy. Well, frig, that was, I believe, the first ever Grey Cup where two former Heck Crichton Trophy winners each scored touchdowns.
Yeah.
People should be talking about that.
Right.
But they have no idea that that's even a thing, because no one probably even mentioned that it was a thing. But indeed it was, because, you know, Buckley won the Heck Crichton at Calgary.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, talk about a city getting a kick in the pants.
Yeah, after the Vanier as well. And
Yeah. The Calgary Dinos lose the Vanier Cup, which went down to like the last 20 seconds. And then the Stampeders, you know, everyone's like, oh, greatest CFL team ever. And they lose the Grey Cup.
Oops. Yeah, tough weekend.
I have to credit, I can remember being at a Red Blacks, like, you know, practice in the August, and someone saying, it's not like Calgary's an all-time great team. They're just winning all these close games. Meanwhile, Ottawa was losing all these close games.
Right.
They lost, six of their nine losses were by seven or fewer points.
Yeah.
I mean, it was just a matter of, you know, would they ever start to actually finish off some of their, you know, red zone visits, and they finally did it.
Yeah. So I've kind of done this backwards, but I was just interested in the analogy there. What were your overall impressions of the game? There are some people saying, you know, it'd be in the conversation for best Grey Cup ever. People throwing around 89, 96. Just general takeaway from it. You know, what did you think?
I would put it in the top three. 1989, I think, still stands as the best one.
Mm-hmm.
For a couple of reasons. One, it was a much, you know, cleanly played game. Like, this one had nine turnovers in it, if I'm not mistaken. Five by Calgary, four by Ottawa. I mean, Henry Burst threw a bad interception. Each team coughed up a couple of fumbles. Whereas I don't really remember the 89 game being like that. I mean, that was just, I mean, that one is always held up as the pinnacle. Saskatchewan beat Hamilton 43-40 on a field goal by Dave Ridgeway with, I think, 2 seconds left in the game. At the time, only Saskatchewan's second Grey Cup ever. They were kind of somewhat similar to the Red Blacks. I mean, they came in lightly regarded. They were a 9-9 team, but I think they had to go on the road to win, to get out of the West Division and beat a 16-2 Edmonton team in the West Final. So that there was all this, you know, no one expected them to be there, but they were playing Hamilton, which was a solid, you know, 12-6 team that had won the East. So, yeah, I mean, a huge Ticat following there, because the Ticats hadn't been in very many Grey Cups in years prior to that.
Right.
But you also had the huge Saskatchewan following there. It was like, you know, all like 30,000 people in green just showed up from points all over the country. And the, so, I mean, it made for, you know, when you look back at it, the atmosphere was, you know, 50-50 down the middle.
That was at the Dome, wasn't it, right after it opened?
Yeah, it was the first one in Sky Dome because it had opened that year, too.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
It had that going for it, and it was, a 43-40, you know, a shootout game. There were lead changes, whereas, you know, Sunday night is, you know, is, I mean, it would have been the greatest comeback ever if Calgary had gone on to win. It would have been the greatest collapse ever by Ottawa, which already owns that distinction, the 1981 team.
Hey, we beat our own record. It's a personal best.
They almost broke their own dubious record. I had someone be like, if this is a repeat of 81, I'm going to cut myself. This was like that text I was getting from somebody.
Yeah.
But I mean, this game didn't have a lead change. It had a little bit of sloppiness. And the crowd wasn't, I mean, the crowd was raucous, but it was a very pro-Ottawa crowd.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, Ottawa was the closer team, and it just seemed like it got a lot louder when Ottawa did something as opposed to when Calgary did something. So
I'd
still say 89. I think another game that's kind of been lost to history, you got to go way back, is 1958.
Right.
Winnipeg and Hamilton.
Sure, we all remember that one.
Yeah, we all remember that one. It was a 35-28 game. They didn't have those back then, but Winnipeg pulled it off, I think, with their backup quarterback playing, and it was a wild game. So that's one that's always up there. This one, I would say top three. And I don't know about the whole greatest upset thing, because I know people are looking at the records. But
yeah,
like I said, I mean, these two teams played in July, and Ottawa was the better team that night. They just happened to fumble on the goal line in the last minute when it was pouring rain.
Yeah.
So they miss a couple of field goals. Otherwise, they win the game in regulation. And I mean, Calgary had a couple of other times during the season. I seem to remember that one against Winnipeg. They blew like a 20-point lead, but then were able to get in field goal range, and Rennie Paradis kicked like a 54-yard field goal on the last play. Scored 10 points in like the last 2 minutes, and then Jonathan Jennings threw a brutal interception in overtime, the BC quarterback. Otherwise, they were like a 13-5 team, and there isn't this greatest team ever conversation.
Well, and I wonder, right, if you start to even just break down the rosters, right, you're looking at a team with Henry Burris and Trevor Harris at quarterback. You got four receivers at 1,000 yards, right? Like, greatest comeback, I don't know, right? Like, you're starting to now have to, I mean, maybe on record, but when you actually look at that roster, that's not a, you know, terrible upstart team, right? Like,
no, not at all. I mean, Greg Ellingson, Ernest Jackson, Brad Sinopoli, that's the best like trio of slot backs that the league has seen in a while. I mean, and Chris Williams.
Chris Williams. Yeah.
He was leading the league for most of the year before he, you know, hurt his knee, but that opened things up. They put in, you know, Jerron Kreiner, and he's just, you know, a beast. I mean, with some of the catches he made during the two playoff games, and Khalil Patton got in as well. A guy who sort of patiently waited his turn to get into the lineup. That was a pretty sick receiving core.
Yeah,
like, you know, one through five. And I seem to remember like there was talk everyone was talking about how Calgary spread the ball around between their receivers, and I remember hearing that midway through, and I was like, which team had the four guys with 1,000 yards again? Now, granted, I mean, some of that was due to the fact Ottawa threw the ball a lot more. I mean, Calgary has messed them, so obviously they were usually playing with the lead, so you throw a little less when that
happens.
Sure,
yeah.
But yeah, I think we were vindicated saying, hey, this is not going to be a blowout at all.
Well, there were times over the course, and I mean, we talked about this in the preview show, where maybe there wasn't a terrific vibe in Toronto leading up to the Grey Cup, but by all reports, Calgary was walking around looking like this was a coronation, right? Show up and do it, and certainly some of the fans looked at it that way, some of the media looked at it maybe more than the team itself, maybe some of the media was guilty of looking at this as like it was going to be a walkover, and we talked about it again, like on the preview show, some of the mainstream media, like guys that even I typically like, but that I haven't seen say a word about Canadian football all summer, are now penning columns all, you know, explaining, you know, greatest Grey Cup ever, or, you know, just kind of what do you really know about this, right? You know what I'm saying? Like, it's kind of, where have you been? You showed up to the big party, and now we're all supposed to listen, right? Like, I don't know. I guess it's something that happens every year, but I felt like for sure there was parts of the media that had painted this as the coronation, right? All Calgary had to do was show up, take the game, and head home with their trophy. And
it's funny thing, if anything, I felt like there wasn't enough of hype about you know, when they had the 16 game undefeated streak during their regular season, because they only lost the first game of the year,
right?
The last game, which was a nothing game because they had home field advantage.
Yeah,
clinched in the West Division half of the playoffs, and in between they went 15-0-1.
It's not too bad.
Yeah, I mean, I was kind of like, you know, this is like historic. I mean, they were threatening to have like the best regular season in league history. Only one team had ever won 16 out of 18 games, and of course that team didn't win the Grey Cup. The 89 Edmonton team. I think one year in the year when they played 16 games, Edmonton went 14-1-1 back in the Warren Moon days.
Sure.
Well, so I felt like there really wasn't a lot of talk. It was just like, oh yeah, Calgary won again. But I just remember, and then, yeah, so I guess I'm breaking my own rule, but we all sort of remember when a certain NFL team was threatening to go on, you know, 19-0, how nauseatingly overdone the coverage was week after week.
Oh, it was terrible, man. Terrible.
How did that Super Bowl go for them?
And I think, yeah, like, but I think by the time that you got to the game, people who couldn't have cared less about the New York Giants were just like, I'm so sick of this. I hope somebody beats these guys, right? Like, it's been months of hearing about New England, and I didn't get the same vibe necessarily off of Calgary where it was quite that vicious, but you're right. Sometimes it doesn't pan out that way in the championship.
Well, I think in any level of serious football, it's hard to beat the same team two or three times in a row.
Yeah.
Like, we've seen that so many times. I mean, that you know, to use that, you know, refer back to that, you know, the Chiefs season in 07. Yeah, they played the Giants in the regular season. And
they almost lost then.
Yeah, they almost lost that.
And, yeah.
I mean, Calgary and Ottawa played, you know, this was their third time playing this season, and Ottawa had almost beaten them once. And the other game was kind of a weird one because it was a post bye week game for Ottawa, but it was also a road trip, so they didn't play for like about 16 days.
Wow!
And I think they just were sleepwalking through the first half of that game. Otherwise, you know, it might have been a bit of a different story. So
right.
I mean, they lost it by 25. I'm not saying they would have won. I'm just saying the score would have looked a lot more respectable. For some reason, and this goes way back to like the Rough Riders days, Ottawa has never played well in Calgary, apparently. Like, ever.
It's kind of strange. The thin air.
Yeah, it is kind of strange. I mean, they've gone out to BC, and, you know, since they've been back, they've gone out to BC and won. I mean, that's a longer trip.
Yeah.
And they played well in BC this year too, but ultimately I think they ended up losing like a 40-33 game because the CFL is just wacky that way. But yeah, I mean, but if people want to, you know, get into the, you know, biggest upset ever narrative, I mean, sure, that's fine. I mean, that, if that's how people connect to sports, right? But I'm saying on another level, yeah, I don't really buy it because I just think Ottawa was a team that, you know, they didn't make enough of their own breaks through the year. Then, you know, maybe they didn't get enough during the year. It was always like this one little thing, like, you know, a pass was dropped, you know, someone, you know, made a cut or whatever, or there was a penalty. There were just little things all through the year. And finally, you know, the breaks evened out in the last two games of the season.
Talk to me a little bit about, you know, you've been around this team now for, did you cover all three seasons up here or just the last two?
I covered all three.
I
actually covered them a little less this year.
Right.
But yeah, I didn't miss a home game the first two seasons.
And you've obviously been around junior hockey up here, and the tie-in there obviously being OSEG, the group who owns the 67s and the Red Blacks. Talk a little bit about this organization and what's happened here, right? Because it was really interesting when the CFL announced that they were coming back to Ottawa. It didn't happen the next year or two. It kept getting pushed back. There was all kinds of delays. There was the fucking Friends of Lansdowne that were in the way. Like, there was a lot of political things that went down here. And then it seemed like once they got up and running, I mean, the first year was pretty ugly, but I mean, to be in the, as a new franchise, to be in the championship game two out of your first 3 years in the league and win it in your third, man, it's spectacular. And I think the job here that, I think they had burned a lot of football fans here in the past with how the Rough Riders left and then the Renegades were just a disaster. And I think there was at least a certain amount of hesitance when they first announced they were coming back for some fans to get on board until you really started to look at Jeff Hunt and his group and how well he had done with the 67s and you had dedicated local ownership, right, to put this up and the fans came running back. Like, how do you see this playing out? Is it still too early to say that, you know, this is going to work here, or is it just because it's novel? Like, how do you see these first couple of years and how this has all come together and culminated on Sunday night?
Well, I think what's happened is, I mean, Jeff Hunt is a great promoter. I mean, he took over the Ottawa 67s in the 90s when the franchise was almost on its last legs and, you know, resurrected them. I mean, obviously their attendance has leveled off for a variety of reasons, some to do with the 67, some to just do with, I think, some general long-term trends that are, you know, working against people going to junior hockey games these days.
You yanked them out to Canada for a year or two, and that wasn't good.
Price point, I think, has gotten a little bit much for people to watch 18-year-old olds go offside. And I mean, there's so much NHL on TV. Why are you going to go pay $24 to watch a lower level of the sport, right?
Yeah.
But I mean, I think they were very adamant. Like, they're going to do this and do it right. I mean, obviously it was an acrimonious process to get the revitalization of Lansdowne Park started, because first, I remember there was the whole, like, I think the city sort of really came to, you know, Roger Greenberg and John Ruddy and the people the developers who were part of the OSEG group, and the city sort of came to them and said, well, here, can you do something here with Lansdowne Park? And I mean, there were other people who said, you know, build at LeBreton Flats, and then Eugene Melnick came up with his cockamamie, well, build me an MLS stadium out in Kanata.
Yeah.
And I sort of remember the first press conference in 2008. I remember the day, October 4th, 2008. Because I was watching it like at home on like Rogers Community TV, and it was kind of ramshackle. Like, they had gotten up there and it was Jeff Hunt with a couple football helmets on the table and like an Ottawa Fury hat or something. And it was kind of like, oh yeah, we'll have soccer too. And it was just like a total throw in. And I was just kind of like, ooh, this guy. And then they're interviewing that Clive Doucette, who was like the city councilor for the Glee board at the time. And he's like, oh, this is just something stupid. And like, he was, and then, of course, like, all these friends of Lansdowne people, because they're Glebites who have no life, had all shown up to pack the meeting and heckle, and it was like, oh my gosh.
Yeah. Got off to a terrible start.
In the Ottawa Sun newsroom, well, I can remember two things. One being that, one columnist, I won't name him, was something like, I'm not going to finish out my career covering a fucking fledgling soccer league, meaning MLS. Meantime, there's going to be like 40,000 people to watch Toronto FC and Montreal Impact on Wednesday night. Some nice fledgling league you got there. This was the same guy who once quoted someone saying Erik Karlsson was a garbage pick. Not going to say who it was.
How's that working out?
Go Google it. Type Erik Karlsson garbage pick and you will find out who it was. So there was all that, and there was the endless legal appeals, and I mean, it was still a tight, I think it was like a 15-9 vote on council to go ahead with Lansdowne Live. And I think there was, like you said, I think you hit the nail on the head, Matt, like, people were kind of reticent, like, are we going to put in all this money in? But at the same time, I mean, the CFL became a better investment over time, right? As I think,
everywhere but Toronto.
I mean, the league, people can look at the 70s as kind of the heyday of the league, because that was probably the last time the CFL could really say it was close to being on par with the NFL.
Right.
In terms of salaries, in terms of, you know, maybe not attendance, just because we have smaller population, but certainly interest was there. And, the caliber of play was probably not that far below the NFL in the 60s and 70s.
Right.
It was only really in the 80s that you started to see the separation really happen. And then the league sort of had its hip, you could almost call its hipster era in the 90s when you had all these, like, you know, great quarterbacks like Doug Flutie and Damon Allen and Tracy Hamm. And meantime, every team was losing money. And, you know, the Saskatchewan Rough Riders were holding a telethon to stay alive. And every year it was like the Ottawa Rough Riders were going to, fold. And
right.
But they, fortunately, you know, some good commissioners. I mean, and they had a series of commissioners who were always like some like old boy who had played football at Upper Canada College or something.
Yeah, yeah.
Like Donald Crump, who was like some Harold Ballard, you know, suck up. Or I mean, John Tory was commissioner.
I remember that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh boy.
Yeah, if he was there, he would have made teams pay a $2 toll every time they crossed the midfield. But they finally got some good commissioners like Tom Wright and Mark Cohan, who finally got the league on a better footing. I think you could go back to the 90s. Larry Smith did, you know, I mean, a lot of people always associate him with the U.S. experiment, but
yeah.
I mean, he did do a lot of things to get the league back, you know, on the radar of corporate Canada. I remember reading once when he took over, he found out they had zero national sponsors.
Oh boy. Yeah. I've got my work cut out for me.
Yeah. So, I mean, you could look at it the fact that this way, it was never the fans in Ottawa. It was always like the stadium sucked and like no sane business person would want any part of owning that team. It was just a bad sports property to be associated with any time really until probably 2010 or so. And they finally said, hey, we're going to come back and we want, and I think they were very good at telling the CFL, you have to do this right this time. Like, you can't screw us over in the expansion process, because I think that's what really happened in 2001. I mean, they weren't able to get a good quarterback, and they ended up with a guy named Dan Crowley, and he was terrible. And that just hurt the Renegades' credibility right off the bat. And I think a lot of other things have happened too that really worked in the favor. I mean, football's a sport that always sort of has to constantly advocate for itself in Canada, right? I mean, it's a physically rough game to play. I mean, right now there's the whole existential crisis with, you know, CTE and everything, right?
Sure, yeah, concussions.
And it goes through periods where people are like, is this sport worth it? And it certainly, that there was a wave of that in the 90s. You'll sort of, I was around university football then. I remember when Carleton folded their program. I remember when U of T threatened to fold theirs and eventually just decided, well, we'll just sort of have a half-assed, de-emphasized
program. Yeah, they might as well have folded it.
Yeah. But I'm getting at is then people after a while realize, well, hey, you know, young boys like to play football, and you know, it's a sport that's got this sort of visceral thrill to it, and it makes a comeback. And I think that is part of it. And I think another part of it is Ottawa's a bilingual city, and you know, Francophone, you know, kids play football a lot more. I mean, that was something the Renegades never really tapped into. I remember hearing the story. They had 22 season ticket holders in Gatineau.
22.
Now there's probably, I don't know what the exact numbers are, but the Red Blacks have 17,000 season tickets, and a lot of more of them come from the other side of the river. And they've really been good about, you know, having, you know, Francophone players that people can identify with, like, you know, Antoine Pruneau and, you know, Jason Lauzon-Séguin. Who I think is really one of the unsung heroes, by the way, in this. I mean, it's one thing for a Canadian rookie from Laval to be starting on offensive line, but he was starting, usually when that happens, it's at guard. He was starting at tackle. I mean, there's probably only at any given time two or three Canadians starting at offensive tackle. That's usually one of the international positions.
Right.
But he handled that like a charm. I mean, Calgary only had one sack on Henry Burris, you know, again, the one-legged quarterback. So, yeah, I think there was a lot of things done to make sure it was done right and everything was sort of done first rate. I know there was a lot of, you know, cautious optimism. I mean, when Rick Campbell was hired as coach, it was kind of like, who is this guy? Like,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
You know, he was a up to that point, he'd only been a coordinator, and coordinators are usually, you know, seen but not heard from, right? So, you know, people didn't really know who he was.
I'm looking at you, Rich Stubler.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, coordinators tend to get reduced to, you know, this one line bio on, you know, that Rod Black says 30 times a game, right? Rich Stubler doesn't have a playbook. He just, you know, it's all just drawn up on napkins. Police, a riverboat gambler.
Yes, exactly.
something like that. You know, Jacques Chaptelin, he looks like a math professor. He's got complicated algorithms to tell them what to call on third and two.
Oh, man. What do you think?
I think everything was just done with class, and, you know, it finally all came together.
So, in your opinion, because, you know, as we've both kind of said now, it's been put together nicely. They're saying the CFL is back in Ottawa, that maybe I've heard once or twice that maybe it's the model franchise right now in the CFL. Do you think it's too soon to say that? Has it been? Obviously, there was going to be attendance in the first year. People wanted to come out and see the new stadium, and it was still novel. The next 2 years, you're successful. Is it the cool thing to do right now in Ottawa, or is there enough of a football fan base in the city that as long as you're not kicking the shit out of them like the league did the last couple of times, that this is going to work? It's going to be successful for the long term.
Well, I know the renewals for next year have already been really good. I mean, what's really, I think, been emphasized there is, you know, the whole game day experience.
And it's like, fantastic.
The line from Jeff Hunt, he's like, we have 15,000 people who will sit on tax to watch football, but that's, you know, we need 10,000 more people. I mean, Matt, you've gone to games there, and it's a happening.
It's
right?
Great, and they do their game ops inside the game with how they treat everything is great. The whole area around it now with these bars and restaurants and stuff that have popped up in the area, it looks like, even if you're passing by, not going to the game, it looks like fun, and it looks like, boy, next time I want to go, right? And once you get in there and actually sit, they do a great job. Like, it's a blast.
And I'm sure at some point it's going to level off.
Sure.
But I think it's been set up in a way that even once, you know, the honeymoon's over, there's still going to be an atmosphere around the stadium, which, you know, speaking, you know, is just hopefully something the Toronto Argonauts will figure out how to develop at BMO Field, because it's certainly there for Toronto FC.
Right.
I mean, Toronto FC's done all sorts of things to, you know, make it about more than just the game, which apparently the Argos hasn't occurred to them yet that they need to do that. But yeah, I mean, that's what I think we're going to stay with it. I mean, and it's really, I mean, I think you could also point out that this is something that they really caught on in Ottawa, because we really haven't had it with the other, you know, sports teams and their stadiums. Like, I mean, the Senators play out in Kanata, right?
And yeah, yeah.
It's just get in your car, go to the game, get back, leave with like 10 minutes left in the third period, beat the traffic, yep. Drive home.
Yeah, no, it's true.
And I mean, and I know people are probably thinking, third year, won a championship, where we heard this before, you know, city all agog, you know, where we heard this before? Oh, right, the Ottawa Lynx back in the 90s. But, you know, look where that ballpark is, you know?
Yeah.
It's in an industrial park. there's like nothing or next. I mean, there's a Canadian Tire. There was nothing next to it back then that whatever it's called now, where the Ottawa Champions play. But I mean, now there's like a Canadian Tire and a Best Buy next door to it. Big whoop, right? I mean, this is something that, you know, it's a central gathering place for people. And I mean, it's really, you know, tapped into something that it just sort of laid dormant for a while in Ottawa. But I mean, I'll always, you know, have good memories of the East final last year, because I remember going to yoga on Sunday morning, then basically getting on the bus to go over to the game. There's people like, I was at the last home playoff game in 1983. Damn, like, this is, you know, a lot bigger than, just the Canadian Football League. And, like I say, I just think the overarching thing is, yeah, I think they have become a model franchise in a lot of ways, because, you know, players really do want to come, and they do really, you know, they do feel like, you know, people know who they are, and, you know, in a way that, you know, doesn't necessarily happen in a larger city. And, you know, the crowd is, you know, for all these people saying that, you know, Ottawa's this humdrum government town, you know, that the crowds are, you know, probably, other than Saskatchewan, probably the most raucous crowd in the CFL.
Wow.
But I think it's all just a combination of things, especially, you know, just making it a, you know, a destination. And I mean, if you want to contrast, I mean, just look at how Hamilton screwed up the whole thing with Tim Hortons Field and where, you know, not putting it in a different part of the city.
Yeah. No, and that's a huge part of it, right? And
I was there for the Vanier Cup on Saturday, me and a couple hundred of my closest friends.
Right.
But it's like, you know, Tim Hortons Field is great. Mm-hmm. Like it looks right. Like impressive, but it's like they just basically rebuilt it on the site of the old stadium. And it's in like the middle of a residential neighborhood. There is nothing around it. Like there are no bars, no restaurants, anything.
Right.
It's like, and I'm like, well, it's funny. I got there, you know, 11:30, and there's like nobody around for a 1 o'clock game. And I'm like, oh crap, I forgot to bring headphones to plug in. So what I'm going to have to, like, you know, I didn't want to be that guy who, you know, plays his like interviews back. So the whole press box hears them.
Yeah.
So I'm like, yeah, I got to get some headphones. So I started like, you know, punching in like nearest Shoppers Drug Mart, and it was like a 15-minute walk away. And I'm just like, screw this.
Yeah, I'll be that guy.
Yeah, I will be that guy. It's just like, you mean there's like, and I'm like looking around. I can't see if like a corner store like within a, and I got upstairs, you know, I get up and you have this amazing view in the press box there. It's like one of the highest press boxes you'll ever be in.
Yeah.
And so you have this whole sort of view. They got the Niagara Escarpment in the background, Lake Ontario. Then you've got all the smokestacks and all that stuff. And I'm just like, wow, this is quite a view. And you know, and our buddy Steve there from OHL Fanboys was like, yeah. Hey, I posted a photo and he goes, hey, you can see my mom's house in that picture. Like, I'll tell your mom to get off the roof.
Yeah,
I was just like, but I'm looking around. It's like I don't see anything that you could even walk to that actually like sells like a legal product over the counter.
Right.
I have to qualify that because it is Hamilton.
Sure.
I was just like, what a bad idea to keep the stadium there. I mean, and yeah, people come, but then I don't know how that works. I don't know how that works. It was just like, oh, Hamilton, I love that city, but for a lot of reasons, but I was just like, why? Like, how did you get this so wrong?
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's definitely a huge part of it to be right downtown here. The thing that's been driving me all crazy today is people that are trying to downplay it, but still suggest that for Ottawa, this is somehow similar to the Cubs, like 100 years of whatever. No, it's not the same. It's the CFL. It's been 40 years.
That's an interesting thing to get into because.
Well, it's two and a half times shorter. It's not the same at all.
Well, but at the same time, though, MLB has 30 teams. And
it's not even the same franchise. Like, that's the thing that drives. Like, I love Senators fans that claim the Senators have won this many Stanley Cups. Yeah, there were 80. You haven't won any Stanley Cups. That you're at zero. Okay, that's what this franchise has won. And you can't. It just drives me nuts. I don't see any comparison at all between one long suffering franchise.
David Naylor made the comparison, and he's a pretty astute guy.
Sure, he is. But it's an easy and lazy comparison. It's one franchise for 100 years that found numerous ways to blow it. You're talking about three franchises here. Well,
Cubs thing wasn't more that they found numerous ways to blow it. It was the fact that they were always the team that never even got good enough to blow it.
Well, that's part of it, too.
It was the Red Sox's thing. I mean,
yes.
I had an interesting conversation with this friend because I was like, well, where were you when the Cubs won? And he's like, I didn't give a shit. Chicago got a World Series in 2005 with the White Sox.
Yeah, no, it's true.
And then he starts like, you know, for our generation, so guys who were, you know, nearing the big 4-0, and when, you know, people are nearing the big 4-0, it was like, you know, the thing we always grew up with was like the Red Sox will never win the World Series. I mean, that was the thing you never even really considered the Cubs winning the World Series because you're just like, it's the Cubs.
They're terrible, but it
finally happened. Yeah, I think it is. I think you're right, though. It is a bit of a lazy comparison.
Yeah.
But it's still like, to have gone, you know, four decades, I mean, 26 seasons of actually fielding a CFL team.
Yeah, you know what? I'm a Leaf fan.
A championship,
I got no sympathy.
How long does that Tony Gabriel catch in the 76 Grey Cup, how long that's been frozen in time? And it wasn't like Ottawa was it wasn't like they were before, you know, they started running into financial troubles on the field. It wasn't like they were a chronic loser. I mean, they were a strong franchise in the East Division for throughout the 60s and 70s. The Toronto Argonauts were the crappy team in the East for most of that period. Or Hamilton was bad. Or
Yeah.
For at times too. I mean, so it was kind of this whole like, Paradise Lost type thing where, and it was the sort of, a, I think it was the, and I think it, at some point too, it was sort of the pain of being on the left on the outside looking in, right?
Definitely.
You don't have a team anymore. And maybe in Ottawa, for people who are come to the city, everyone in Ottawa is usually, come there to go to school or, work in government. So, it was something, you need sort of that thing that you identify with. And the CFL is one way to get that because it's the more accessible, sports, entertainment product. I mean, yep. The NHL, I mean, you gotta have some, cash in your pockets to be able to go to an NHL game these days. And, it was something we didn't have. And I mean, I think that's why people always really identified with it as something that was, made Ottawa stand out and perhaps the fact that it's something that's not embraced as much in Montreal and Toronto also drew people to it. I mean, it was a way of emphasizing our Ottawa-ness to get involved with the CFL or to, have 20,000 people come out to the Panda game or, 10,000 people go to watch Carlton and Ottawa U play basketball once a year.
Yep.
And, to be part of it, feel like part of that big victory, right? I mean, I think the Cubs comparison is a little lazy. I think maybe if you're looking for, comparisons in the big wide world sports, I think the Cleveland comparison is a little bit better.
Yeah, that could be, but I don't want to go too far down this road.
Like we needed something, right?
Yep. Yeah, it's true. As a Leaf fan, they got a decade even to catch me, so they can stop worrying about the Cubs. I'm 50 years without a championship. I want to move on to the last thing here. And no one knows. I've seen him asked about it numerous times since the game ended. Henry Burris, 41 years old, wins a championship. I guess, like I said, no, there's no way to know for sure. But your gut, you think he's coming back?
I think he is. Yeah. But obviously he's going to have to decide about the knee. But, I mean, he already said at the end of May that, he was coming back in 2017.
Right.
And he's restructured his contract. So he'll make less money than Trevor Harris next year.
Okay.
The question is Trevor Harris going to be happy not starting? And I mean, but this year it was really interesting. I think I said it before on here. What always got me when Burris went on that whole thing with, people on TSN talking junk about him.
Yeah.
I don't think it was ever about him versus Trevor Harris who should start. I think it was about people questioning his ability because of his age that I think was really, graded on him. It was, I think, and I, you know, I mean, obviously, you know, Smiling Hank, he can, talk an auctioneer into the ground and he could probably tell you the sky is green and make you believe it, but there's never really been as loquacious as he is, I don't think he ever really tries to hustle people, if you know what I mean.
Sure.
He's always completely sincere in what he says and does. I always thought like if, Harris was clearly the guy to play, he would be like, okay, fine. Harris is the guy and I'll be the backup and ready to come in. I mean, he handled it really well during the season when Trevor Harris was starting. and it was probably good that they're a little bit different personality wise. I mean, Harris is a guy, he's got a fun side to him, but he doesn't show it as much. And he's, sort of a polite yes sir, no sir type of guy. And I mean, you can't have two people who are exactly the same,
right? Yeah.
Personality type with when you have that situation with two different quarterbacks and so I don't think it's like really,
I think that's the bigger issue though.
I don't think it's ever really going to be a thing where it divides the locker room because the CFL is always unique in that most teams will need both quarterbacks at some point during an 18 game season. It's not like the NFL that way.
But the problem that I see, if there's going to be a problem, isn't so much Burris. It's, as you mentioned a few minutes ago, Does Harris want to back up again for another season? And the team needs to decide, are we willing to jeopardize him being unhappy or losing him to go with a 42-year-old quarterback next year? Now, it's one who just won us a championship and the most outstanding player of that championship. Last year, I believe he was the most outstanding player of the league, if I'm not mistaken. So it's not like he's been bad and you just keep going back out of loyalty. There is still some, but eventually that's going to drop. And if Harris becomes unhappy, and you know, I wonder if it wouldn't be better for the team to hope, you know, it won't be their decision, obviously, but to hope maybe this is it for Burris. Just,
yeah, that's possible. I mean, in the back of their mind, but I mean, as crazy as it sounds, I could still see a scenario where, you know, they just sort of go 1A and 1B again. I mean, hey, I think Trevor Harris will be 31 next season, I want to say. So, I mean, there's still a lot of time left for him in the league, but he, at the same time, he's also obviously their future, and yeah. it's going to have to happen sooner or later. But like, I just feel like, I mean, Burris is a guy who will have probably a sense of, okay, you know, the law of diminishing returns has kicked in, and it's you know, it's time to get out.
Yeah, got to be tempting to go out on a championship, right?
It has to be, but yeah. At the same time, I always come back to something. You know, Bob House, who the former Queens coach, who was part of those Edmonton teams in the 70s and 80s, something said, he's like, very seldom in sports does anyone get to win their last game.
Yep.
I mean, other than Peyton Manning and I guess John Elway both got to do it.
Sure.
And when he told me that, it was after Elway, but
yeah.
So I had to think that if depending on how hurt Burris's knee is, I mean, that he'd probably be willing to give it another shot. And if it's not, and if it doesn't feel the same in training camp, I mean, guys know when it's their time. I think when you get down to it, it's when you don't have the, I'll never know what this is like, but I think it's when you don't have the passion for something,
right?
And you know it's not there.
Yeah,
that it's time to go. Like there's always that story of Jerry West, the you know NBA great, told. He said, you know, he used to always get bottled up full of nervous tension, you know, before games, and he had all these rituals, and he, you know, he'd be like, you know, sweating buckets. And he said there was one day he was getting ready for a game, and that wasn't there anymore, and he was just like, okay, time to retire.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't know. I think maybe in the course of this match, I'm going to convince myself that Burris is going to retire. But I can't see a guy who's just got that much, you know, sort of lust for life just saying, okay, this is it. I'm retiring after, you know, having one of the greatest Grey Cup performances ever. And I mean, you're talking about someone who's got a lot of vitality to him. I mean, the age is just a number. I mean, there was, you know, a nice story in the New York Times by Curtis Rush mentioning, you know, how his dad, you know, Hank Sr., I guess, well, Henry is like 70 and he still goes out and bales hay down in Oklahoma. Like some people, like they just have that extra, you know,
that's true.
You know, bit of energy. I say this as I'm lying here on my bed for the last 4 hours. So we'll see.
Yeah.
We'll see.
It'll be an interesting story to follow through the off season. And the interview in his, when he was at the podium after the game, he said, you know, what's next? And he said, well, next weekend, I got to drive back down here to Toronto to take my kids to a hockey tournament. So he is a family man too, right? He's got his family at home, and maybe it's time he's ready to spend a little more time with them. It's one of those things that you don't really know until you get right inside the guy's head.
Yeah, so, and I think the other factor in that probably didn't come up is, I mean, there's been a lot of coverage about, you know, Henry and Nicole Burris and how much of a thing it's been for them to try to take out Canadian citizenship.
Yeah.
And I mean, I wonder if, you know, how much that plays a factor in, you know, in whether to play football. Because I mean, if there's an opportunity to do TV work, and if that helps his chances of, you know, naturalizing in Canada,
mm-hmm.
maybe that's, I don't know anything about that or have any insight into it, but I mean, maybe that plays into circumstances a little as well. So,
yep, could be.
You know, it's certainly going to be interesting. But I mean, I don't think anyone should, you know, downplay what a, you know, if that was it. I mean, what a way to finish it.
It's true, and that's not a bad way to finish this one. another episode of Tall Can Sports. Nate Sager, you can follow Nate on Twitter at Nate Sager, NaitSayger. You can find his stuff under the CFL tab on the Score app and all over Sportsnet as well. You guys are fucking everywhere. Nate, thanks a lot for doing this.
And thank you, Matt.
Yeah, and we will see the rest of you on the next episode of Tall Can Sports.
Well, this one's empty. For more, visit tallcanaudio.com or find us on Twitter and Facebook at Tall Can Audio.